Now, in this portion of our study, we're going to be talking about the book of Revelation, which I suspect is the main reason you came over here today, was to hear what we would have to say relative to the book of Revelation. And it is an interesting study, and I want to express my appreciation to you for coming and the interest that you have in it, for the simple reason that there are some brethren who are afraid of the book of Revelation, and they just will not study it. We have some brethren whose minds are so closed by prejudice that they won't listen to another view other than what they've already heard. And I appreciate the fact that you're not of that kind. You do not fit into either one of those groups, and you're willing to study the book of Revelation. As you probably already have ascertained, the position that I take on the book of Revelation is not the traditional view that is held by most brethren. If we were to take a percentage of the brethren who would hold to the view that I hold, you might be rather surprised to find that it might be less than 1%. But that doesn't disturb me, because the Lord said, few there be that find it. Talking about something else, but that may have been true relative to the book of Revelation, too. So, for the most part, those who have a definite view on the book of Revelation hold what we call the late date view. That was my view until about 10 years ago right now. And I began to change my thinking about that because I was studying the book myself and I was seeing some things that I had not seen before. And so I began to change my view. Most of you probably still hold to that view, and I'd not fall out with you because of that. You may change your thinking about that in the course of the study today. I hope you at least consider what I'm going to have to say. I think there's a segment in the brotherhood who really don't have a view on the book of Revelation. They just more or less think, well, it's a difficult book, and they'd like to know what it's about, but they haven't really heard it yet. And they want to know what the book of Revelation is about. I really am making my appeal to this group of people who want to know what the book is about and who have an ear and are willing to listen for just a few moments. Now, I'm going to be very specific in what I have to say. And you're going to see that I am totally confident that I'm right. And you may go away assessing that I'm dogmatic. And I confess to it, I am dogmatic. I don't intend to hide that from you at all. And the reason why I'm dogmatic is because John says in Revelation 1 and verse 1 that this book is about things that are shortly to come to pass. Those are historical events that were to happen. They are specific. And you ought to be able to put your finger on them. And I suggest to you that any position that cannot specifically pinpoint those events admits that it doesn't know what the book's about. Just readily admits it doesn't know what the book's about. And I believe that the book conclusively pinpoints what those primary events were, and that they demand a specific explanation of what those things were that were shortly to come to pass. Now, having said that, I'm not going to fall out with you if when I get through, you don't agree with what I had to say. And the reason I don't fall out with those who disagree is, number one, the book of Revelation and a knowledge of it, I do not believe, is necessary to go into heaven. I don't believe that. I believe that it will afford you a great blessing if you understand it. I believe we're warned against adding to it or taking from it, so we have to be careful what we do with it. But I do not believe that a knowledge of it is absolutely essential to you going to heaven, any more than I believe that a knowledge of the Old Testament Scriptures is essential to going to heaven. I don't believe you have to know everything the Old Testament teaches to go to heaven. I believe you can be saved without knowing anything about it. But it sure helps to know about the scheme of redemption and how it worked and how it worked in the Old Testament Scriptures. And it really opens up the avenues to understanding, to know about the Old Testament Scriptures. And I believe that the book of Revelation falls into this same category and for those same reasons. I think, too, that brethren usually try to harmonize the positions they take on the book of Revelation with what the rest of the Scriptures teach. I have confidence in my brethren that they're not going to come up with some false position like premillennialism and Jehovah's Witness doctrines. by study of the Revelation. They know those are wrong, and I've said it before, and I said it just a few moments ago. Brethren have been very good telling people what the book was not about. But you let one of them explain to a Jehovah's Witness that the 144,000 is not who he says it is, and then turn around and ask him who they are, and he can't tell you. He knows who they aren't, but he doesn't know who they are, so that makes a difference. Brethren, though I have confidence in, generally speaking, though that may not be totally true, are going to try to harmonize the book of Revelation with what the rest of the Scriptures teach. And then a third thing is, I don't believe the cause of truth has ever been served by falling out with those you differ with. I think that if you have things over which you differ, the thing you need to do is to sit down and discuss it. Present your case. Let it be considered from the pros and cons. If it's false, somebody will show you it's false. And when they do, be man enough to accept it. And when I get through here today, if you want to expose what I have presented as false, I tell you before I begin, I'm man enough to take it. I want to be right with God, and I do not want to teach something that is false. Now, I think that we need to have an open-minded, friendly study of this and every issue that comes before us. Now, I'm going to seek to be forceful. I really don't have to seek to do that, because I've been making these arguments for nearly 10 years now, and I haven't had anybody to answer them yet. And if you answer them today, you'll be the first one, and then we'll just quit talking about them all together and go back to confusion like we were before. But that's basically what we're going to do. Now, since this position that I take is generally rejected and has been through the years, I use a forceful presentation to try to get people's attention. You heard about the fellow, you know, who bought the mule, and he couldn't get him to work. The fellow said he'd do anything you told him to do, and he couldn't get him to work. And so he called him up on the phone, and he invited him to, told him to come over. Said, "You said this mule would do anything you asked him to do." And he said, "I can't even get him out of the stall." He said, "I'll be over in a minute." So he went over, and as he went into the barn, he picked up a 2x4, and he walked in. He hit the old mule over the head with a 2x4. He said, "What'd you do that for?" He said, "I told you had to get his attention first." So sometimes you have to get people's attention. And I make a presentation like this forcefully for the purpose of getting people's attention. And if in the course of it you feel like you're being challenged and the position you've held in times past is being challenged, it is. It's being challenged. And it's going to be challenged all across this country until somebody answers what I've got to say relative to this subject. Now, saying that, I realize I'm a man and I'm fallible, I make mistakes, and I've changed a lot of times, and I'm willing to change again. So I consider myself open-minded, and if you see some flaw in what I present today, I want you to feel free to point it out to me. You'll be my friend if you do that. Now, I'm going to divide my discussion into three parts. First of all, I'm going to give you an overview of the whole book. And secondly, I'm going to get into the identification of the primary subject matter. And then thirdly, I'm going to give you about a 5 to 10 minute explanation of the whole book. You think I can do that? Stay tuned. We'll do our best. And I think we can give it to you in a way that you'll understand what the book's about. Now, my approach to establishing the date of the book, and that's really what we have to do, there's no need of talking about a lot of the different views that are held on the book of Revelation until you've established something relative to the date. And that's what everybody feels is necessary in the study of the book of Revelation. We have to get to the root of when the date was established, or when we established the date, when it was written. Now, there are a number of circumstantial clues as to when the book was written that may be explored, but I'm not going to explore them in this discussion. If you have purchased the book, many of you have, there is a section in here upon the circumstantial evidences, the clues. But the problem with circumstantial evidence is that it's subject to dual interpretation. The circumstances in a particular case may look like it leans one way, but in reality it may lean the other. And you are called upon to form an opinion, to reach a judgment relative to that. And so I'm not going to talk about those today because they're not conclusive. They did not reach a conclusive position as to when this book was written. So they may contribute to it, but they do not reach one. Now, it is my opinion that the circumstantial evidences lean more heavily in favor of the position that I hold. But I'll not seek to use those as a basis upon which to establish the position that I'm going to take. And those who argue for the late date position use a form of argument that I believe is sound. And it works like this. It's understood that the book is about events that are shortly to come to pass. Those are historical events. And they've gone through the book and they have found various places where the book talks about something, and so they've been able to identify what those things are. And identifying those things, they have a reason that the book had to be written just prior to the accomplishing of these things, so therefore the book was written in 96 A.D. That's the basis upon which that's reached. I believe that's a valid way to approach it, and that's the way I'm going to approach it. I think that the only problem there is that they have identified the secondary subject matter as the primary subject matter, and as a result have reached the wrong conclusion upon the date. I'm going to show you what I believe conclusively from the teaching of the Scriptures has to be the primary subject matter, and therefore the date has to be reversed back to the previous to the accomplishment of those things. So that's the primary approach that I'm going to take. The book is about things that are shortly to come to pass. And I want you to notice here the importance of what John has been told by the angel of the Lord, or by the Lord himself, in relationship to what is to be the content of this book. In verse 19 of the first chapter, John is commissioned, "Write the things which thou hast seen, and the things which are, and the things which shall be hereafter." Now, if we only take the first verse, we may just think that there's nothing in this book except things that are shortly to come to pass. And if you do that, you'll make a serious mistake, because there are things that are symbolized in the book of Revelation that have already passed. There are things that are symbolized in the book of Revelation that are going on right then. There are things that are symbolized in the book of Revelation that are yet to come to pass. So you have all three. Now, some, upon the basis that all things were shortly to come to pass, have tried to interpret the whole book that way. So when we get over to Revelation 20, verses 11 through 15, they've interpreted that judgment scene, the resurrection, the judgment scene there, as applying to judgment against the Roman Empire. The reason for that is because of verse 1. I think that's totally unnatural to the context and to the book. Anyone who looks at Revelation chapter 20 knows that there is a 1,000-year period. Regardless of what position you take on that, it's a long period of time, and at the close of that, there's some things that are to happen, and that comes in chronological order. That has to be understood. So you're not talking about everything in the book shortly coming to pass. There are things in the book that do shortly to come to pass, but there are some things in the book that are still way off in the future. Some of them haven't come to pass yet. I don't think. I don't think the resurrection and the judgment taking place yet. And I believe that that passage in Revelation 20, 11 through 15 does identify that. So we have to understand that John's commission was to write the things that were past, the things that are present, things which are, and the things which shall be hereafter. Now, those things which shall be hereafter are the future things. These are to be divided into two categories: those that were shortly to come to pass, and those that were projected for the future. Those that were shortly to come to pass are the primary events. I believe that they are revealed in chapters 4 through 19 and 10. Not that there is nothing in that section that are secondary events, because there are some secondary events referred to in those chapters. But the primary subject matter is recorded in those chapters. From chapter 19, 11, on through chapter 20 and verse 6, we have some secondary subject matter events that are to be projected for the early centuries. Early centuries. And then, from chapter 20 and verse 7 on through chapter 20 and verse 15, we have those that are projected on toward the end of time. So we have some real future events that are to take place. So we have to understand, I think, that we have both immediate future events that are revealed in the book of Revelation, and we have some secondary events that are yet projected for the future. Now, with that before our minds, I want us to take a look at the overall book itself and how it is to be divided up. As you know, there are 22 chapters. And we would divide those chapters into four different sections. The first section we would call Christ Among the Lampstands, or the churches, chapters 1-3. And then the second section I call the Heavenly Apocalypse. We'll tell you why after a while, chapters 4-11. And then the third division, the Earthly Apocalypse, chapters 12-20. And then the fourth section, the New Jerusalem, as it is presented in those two chapters. Now let me make some observations about these divisions. Chapters 1-3 are the first division, and chapters 21 and 22 are related. I believe that they are picturing the same thing. Chapters 1-3, with Christ among the churches, is picturing the church on earth in its local and physical sense, and in its imperfect sense. Chapters 21 and 22 are viewing the same thing, yet from a broader standpoint, in its universal, spiritual, and heavenly sense. And it's perfect. There is no impurity in it whatsoever. So, here we see the church as it is on earth today, and we are part of it. Here we see it as the universal body of Christ, with those who are acceptable to God at any moment, whether they're on earth or whether they're already dead, because they are part of that. You have a picture of this order, the New Testament order, in its entirety, inclusive both of living and dead saints, but in which there is no imperfection in this new spiritual city. Now, in these two sections here, we never see the church referred to in this sense. It is always referred to in this particular sense. So that as you go through the middle chapters, whenever you're reading about the people of God there, you're reading about them in this perfected sense as identified over here in chapters 21 and 22. Now we center in on the middle section, because that is where the events that are signified, to shortly to come to pass, are revealed. If you look at chapter 4 and verse 1, you notice that it starts off that way. After this I looked, and behold, a door was opened in heaven, and the first voice which I heard was, as it were, of a trumpet talking with me, which said, come up hither, and I will show thee things which must be hereafter. So this is the beginning of the revelation of the things that are shortly to come to pass. Now, I call the first section, chapters 4-11, the Heavenly Apocalypse. I call it that for this reason. You have the transition in heaven, in verses chapters 4 and 5, from the rule of God to the rule of Jesus Christ. So you have a new heavenly order. And the events that are shortly to come to pass are under the authority of this new heavenly order. And the things that are carried out, there is a judgment carried out. And the judgment that is carried out is under the order and the direction of the throne of God. It is not an accident. It's ordered and directed by the throne of God in heaven. In chapters 12-20, I call it the earthly apocalypse, because you see the same thing, except here you're seeing it accomplished from the standpoint that the heavens use earthly instruments. And you also see a new earth from the standpoint of its spiritual relationship to God. Emphasis is placed upon that. So in this particular section, you're looking at the heavens under control here, and here you see the earthly instruments that are used by God in the carrying out of His vengeance upon the ones who are the objects of His wrath that is to be poured out. Now, in the course of the study today, I'm going to be presenting for you one argument. Just one argument. that identifies the subject matter of this book. The argument that I'm going to use is considered by those who hold the late date view, I'm sure, to be the weakest argument that I can make. But I consider it to be the strongest argument that I can make. And for that reason, because others consider it to be the weakest, I make the argument in order to show you how strong it really is. And I hope you will listen carefully to the things that I'm going to have to say. Now, I'm going to build my case for the date of the book and for the primary subject matter upon the vengeance promised in those two sections that we were talking about. Now, the first one that we want to observe are the passages of Scripture in chapters 4 through 11 that promise God's vengeance upon those who are His enemies. If you will notice in chapter 6, verses 9 through 10, we have this vengeance that is called for there. It says, "And when he opened the fifth seal, he said, I saw under the altar the souls of them that were slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they held. And they cried with a loud voice, saying, How long, O Lord, holy and true, dost thou not judge and avenge our blood on them that dwell on the earth?" I believe the first great mistake made in the study of the book of Revelation by most people is the identification of these souls. They are usually equated with the souls that are seen in chapter 20 and verse 4. I believe that's a sad mistake. And the reason I believe it is a sad mistake is because it ignores what is said in the text. Now, here's some dead souls. They're under an altar. They've been sacrificed. And let me just make this observation that you'll see in chapters 4, 5, and 6, well, in some of the other chapters too, a comparison to the Old Testament order. You have before the throne of God, you have the lamps burning. You have out in front of the throne of God, you have the brazen sea, the glassy sea rather. And then you have the 24 elders around about the throne. And now you have an altar of sacrifice. Later on in chapter 8, you have an altar of incense. And I think that all bears back to the fact that the Apostle Paul says, if he be the writer of Hebrews, in Hebrews 10 and 1, for the law having a shadow of things to come, and not the very image. And then also in the previous chapter he makes the statement that those things back there of the Old Testament law were a pattern of the heavenly things. That here you have a picture of the heavenly things as they're presented here. But anyway, you have this altar. And these souls are under the altar. They've been slain for the word of God. Now, it doesn't say that they were slain for the testimony of Jesus, as is said in 20 and verse 4. They're slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they held. And what they're asking is, Lord, how long is it going to be until you judge and avenge our blood on them that dwell on the earth? Now, they're dead. And they want their blood avenged. Now, who are they? I believe these are dead servants of God who've been resting for a while. They have just now received their white robes. I want you to notice that in verse 11. It says, and white robes were given unto every one of them. Now, they've been dead for a while. And now he says they're given white robes. Why are they now just given white robes? In chapter 7, verse 14, we understand that their white robes are made white in the blood of the Lamb. I suggest that the reason why they're just now getting white robes is because they died under the Old Testament, and that the sacrifice of Christ for the blood, I mean, the sacrifice of Christ's blood for in which they would be cleansed had not been offered until in the previous chapter. And so now, that being so, they raise this question, and now they're given white robes. Otherwise, we have to ask the question, why didn't they already have white robes? They're now given white robes. And it said unto them that they should rest yet a little season until their fellow servants also and their brethren that should be killed as they were should be fulfilled. So they're given white robes and they're told to rest a little while longer. There are going to be some fellow servants and some of their brethren who's going to be killed as they were. And then, after all that's been accomplished, they will be avenged. All right, that's when it is first made known. Now, the rest of this section is about the avenging of their blood. When we get down to the end of the section in chapter 11 and in verses 17 and 18, we read this. We give thee thanks, O Lord God Almighty, which art and was and art to come, because thou hast taken to thee thy great power and hast reigned, and the nations were angry, and thy wrath is come, and the time of the dead, that they should be judged. That's what they asked for up there, you see. That they should be judged, and that thou shouldest give reward unto thy servants, the prophets, and to the saints, and them that fear thy name, small and great, and shouldest destroy them which destroy the earth. When you get to the end of this section, you see, a city has been destroyed, and God has avenged the blood of those dead saints. He's avenged it. Now then, let's go into the next section. Chapters 12 through 20, we see some more scenes where vengeance is being called for and poured out. In chapter 16, 5 and 6, we read, "And I heard the angel of the water say, Thou art righteous, O Lord, which art, and wast, and shalt be, because thou hast judged thus. For they have shed the blood of saints and prophets, and thou hast given them blood to drink, for they are worthy." In chapter 18 and verse 20, after Babylon the Great has been destroyed, we see this statement made in regard to what is taking place. He said, "Rejoice over her, thou heaven, and ye holy apostles and prophets, for God hath avenged you on her." And whoever Babylon the Great is, God has destroyed her to avenge the holy apostles and prophets. Then in chapter 18 and verse 24, he says, "And in her was found the blood of prophets and of saints and of all that were slain upon the earth." I want you to remember these, because we're going to come back to them in a few moments. Now then, here are the conclusions. A city is destroyed. She's called Babylon the Great in these last sections here. And up in the first section there, a city was destroyed, but she wasn't called Babylon the Great. We'll get back to that in a while. But it's still the same city. She's called Babylon the Great. She's destroyed as vengeance from God. The reason was that in her was found the blood of prophets, saints, and of all that were slain upon the earth. When it was accomplished, it was to be considered as God avenging of the holy apostles and prophets. Now let's take a look at the vengeance that Jesus promised during his personal ministry. Let me make this observation before I forget it. This is the message of Jesus in Revelation. He signified it unto John by his angel. Now we have another message of Jesus, one which he gave while he's here upon the earth, and it's the same message. In Luke 13, 31 through 33, text says, "The same day there came certain of the Pharisees, saying unto him, Get thee out, and depart hence, for Herod will kill thee. And he said unto them, Go ye and tell that fox, Behold, I cast out devils, and I do cures today and tomorrow, and the third day I shall be perfected. Nevertheless, I must walk today and tomorrow and the day following. For it cannot be that a prophet perish out of Jerusalem. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, which killest the prophets, and stonest them that are sent unto thee, how often would I have gathered thy children together, as a hen doth gather her brood under her wings, and ye would not. Behold, your house is left unto you desolate." Jesus there was speaking about Jerusalem, and what was going to happen to Jerusalem because she killed the prophets. So, bear in mind now, that Babylon the Great was destroyed as vengeance from God because she had found in her the blood of prophets. The prophet's blood was found in her. Now in another text, in Luke 11, 45 through 51, "Then answered one of the lawyers and said unto him, Master, thou sayest, thus say, thou reproachest us also. And he said, Woe unto you also, ye lawyers, for ye laid men with burdens grievous to be borne, and ye yourselves touch not the burdens with one of your fingers. Woe unto you, for ye build the sepulchres of the prophets, and your fathers killed them. Truly ye bear witness that ye allow the deeds of your fathers. For they indeed killed them, and ye build the sepulchres, their sepulchres. Therefore also said the wisdom of God, I will send them prophets and apostles, and some of them they shall slay and persecute, that the blood of all the prophets, which was shed from the foundation of the world, may be required of this generation." Now note that. He said, I'm sending them apostles and prophets, and they're going to slay some of them and persecute them. Why? That the blood of, now get it, all of the prophets will be required of this generation. God promised to avenge the blood of all of the prophets on Jerusalem. Again, in chapter 23, we have a similar text to this scathing denunciation that Jesus pronounced upon the Jews on his final full day in the city of Jerusalem before his betrayal and crucifixion. And following this is we have chapter 24 of Matthew, in which Jesus is foretelling the destruction of Jerusalem. But in the midst of this, he says essentially the same things. He says, woe unto you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you build the tombs of the prophets and garnish the sepulchres of the righteous. And you say, if we had been in the days of our fathers, we would not have been partakers with them in the blood of the prophets. Wherefore, you be witness unto yourselves that ye are the children of them which killed the prophets. Fill ye up then the measure of your fathers, ye serpents, ye generation of vipers. How can ye escape the damnation of hell? Wherefore, behold, I send you prophets and wise men and scribes, and some of them ye shall kill and crucify, and some of them ye shall scourge in your synagogues and persecute them from city to city, that upon you may come all the righteous blood shed upon the earth, from the blood of righteous Abel unto the blood of Zacharias, the son of Barachias, whom you slew between the temple and the altar. Verily I say unto you, all these things shall come upon this generation. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, thou that killest the prophets, and stonest them that are sent unto thee, how often I would have gathered thy children together, even as a hen gathered her chickens under her wings, and so on. So again, he says that Jerusalem would be held responsible for the death of the prophets. Now, let's see the conclusive chart. Here's the observations that we see from these two sections. The vengeance from the book of Revelation and the vengeance from the personal ministry of Jesus. Here in the personal ministry of Jesus, he has taught us that Jerusalem, including the temple, was to be destroyed as vengeance from God. The reasons were that was in her was found the blood of all was found all the righteous blood shed upon the earth. And he said it would be required of the generation then living as vengeance from God. Now that compared to the observation from Revelation is this. The city is destroyed, called Babylon the Great, as vengeance from God. The reason was that in her was found the blood of prophets, saints, and of all that were slain upon the earth. You see the comparison between the two? When it was accomplished, it was to be considered as God avenging of the holy apostles and prophets. Now, it appears to me the conclusion has to be that the essentials being identical, therefore the Babylon the Great, the city that is destroyed, who is the mother of harlots, upon whom God avenged the blood of all that were slain upon the earth, is Jerusalem and cannot possibly be any other. That is a conclusion that to me appears to be absolute from that standpoint. But I want to go back and go over it again. If you'll give me that previous chart that you just had there a moment ago, Jack, we'll take a look at it. You'll notice that Jesus said in Luke 13:33, he said, for it cannot be that a prophet perish out of Jerusalem. That statement means something. He just didn't throw it out in the wind to say something. And what he said was, it cannot be that a prophet perish out of Jerusalem. If that's the case, then a prophet could not have perished anywhere else except Jerusalem, and Babylon the Great couldn't be anybody, any other city, except Jerusalem. But I'm told that that's what is called an hyperbole. That is, where something is overstated. And I can buy that. Now, sometimes that's done. But the statement still means something. What does it mean? I think what it means is this. I know that all the prophets did not die in the city of Jerusalem. And I don't think that Jesus meant to say that all the prophets would die in the city of Jerusalem. John the Baptist didn't die there, and there was no greater prophet than he. But I think what Jesus is saying is simply this, that the nation of Israel was responsible for them. The nation of Israel was responsible for the death of the prophets. Though they didn't all die in Jerusalem, Jerusalem was the capital. And whenever the nation of Israel turned on God's prophets and rejected them, Jerusalem was the one at whose doorstep it was laid, because that was the capital, that was the seat of government, that was the seat of religion. And usually, they both went together. And so he laid it squarely at the door of Jerusalem, because the nation of Israel was responsible for the death of the prophets. Now, somebody said, well, that's true. In this particular passage, he's talking about the Old Testament prophets. But you know, in these other passages, he would send them New Testament prophets. And Jerusalem was responsible for the death of the Old Testament prophets, but she wasn't responsible for the death of the New Testament prophets. Well, let's look. Here's what he said. He said, I will send them prophets and apostles, and some of them they shall slay and persecute, that the blood of all the prophets. He's sending them New Testament prophets, whom they're going to slay and persecute, that the blood of all the prophets, that gets your Old Testament prophets, as well as your New Testament prophets, which was shed from the foundation of the world, may be required of this generation, and it's going to be required on Jerusalem. Now, the position most people take on this is that Babylon the Great is wrong. But now you've got a problem. You've got to prove that Babylon the Great as Rome, if that was Rome, you've got to prove that Rome was responsible for the death of a single prophet. Forget the Old Testament prophets. Just prove that she was responsible for the death of a New Testament prophet. And the only thing you can say about that is, well, I know that possibly Rome was responsible for the death of Paul. Possibly was responsible for the death of Paul. We don't really know that. I believe she was. I mean, I believe Nero had Paul put to death. But I don't believe that Paul was his problems were caused by Rome's persecution of saints. Oh yes, Rome was persecuting saints in Jerusalem. But you see, why was Paul there in the first place? The first imprisonment of Paul was there because he was betrayed there by his own brethren. I think there's evidence in 2 Timothy that he was betrayed the second time because of Jewish brethren. And that he made his appeal to Rome because he had that right to make that appeal to Rome. Had he not appealed to Rome, he might not have been killed because he just happened to be at the wrong place at the wrong time. Nero was having Christians put to death, and he happened to be one. I mean, he was there at the wrong time. I think that's the reason why Demas forsook him. I think that's the reason why all men forsook him. They knew what was going on in Rome when he was taken to Rome that second time and made his appeal. He knew his death, his end was doomed. But not because of the fact that Rome was persecuting the Christians and he just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. Well, be that as it may. But suppose we grant Paul God going to reap his destruction upon Babylon the Great at Rome simply because of one man. Is that what's going to happen? You couldn't name one after the destruction of Jerusalem if you had to, that Rome was responsible for the death of. The fact is, you don't even know that there were any prophets after 70 A.D. Much less that Rome was responsible for them. Oh yes, Rome gets into the picture even in Revelation in persecuting saints. But that is after the fact, and I'll show you that in just a little while. So, these passages of Scripture, it appears to me, preclude the possibility of Babylon the Great being any city except Jerusalem. Now give me your other one there. I want to go back to this first one here. In chapter 6 of Revelation, where they cry for vengeance, how long will it be, O Lord, before you judge our blood and avenge our blood on them that dwell upon the earth? And when we come to this final section down there, we find that they have been avenged. I want you to turn to Revelation 11, and I want you to look at something here. There's a city that has just been wiped out in Revelation 11, and she's been wiped out as vengeance from God. I think it rather strange. Well, not really strange. I think it rather wonderful, really, because this helps us to understand it. That in the very first verse of chapter 11, John is given a reed that's like unto a rod, and the angel stood saying, rise and measure the temple of God and the altar and them that worship therein. But the court which is without the temple leave out and measure it not, for it is given unto the Gentiles, and the holy city shall be trod under foot 42 months. Now, here's a city here that's been mentioned here. And this city is finally destroyed, wiped out. It's wiped out to avenge God's people, and it just so happens that this city that is symbolically presented here has a temple in it. It's got an outer court. And it's called the Holy City. There's only two holy cities in the Bible, Jerusalem and New Jerusalem. You could never refer to Rome as a holy city, but this city is the holy city. He says that his two witnesses now witness against the city in sackcloth and ashes, and they're killed. And if you read those passages, you'll find that they symbolize the law of Moses, given by Moses, and the prophets, given symbolized by Elijah. And then it says they're killed in verse 7. And when they have finished their testimony, the beast that riseth out of the bottomless pit shall make war against them. This is the same beast that is developed in chapter 13 and chapter 17 in the next section, and that destroy Babylon the Great. He says, this beast is going to make war against them, that is against these two that testify, the law and the prophets, and they're going to overcome them and kill them, and their dead bodies shall lie in the street of the great city. And the only city identified as great in the book of Revelation is Babylon the Great, New Jerusalem, and this verse here. They lie in the street of the great city, which spiritually is called Sodom and Egypt, where also our Lord was crucified. He was crucified in Jerusalem, if you remember correctly. He goes ahead to show some things relating to the prophets, their resurrection from the dead, and they're being called up to heaven. And then the seventh angel sounds and it's all over. And when this is all over, he says in verse 15, it says that the voices in heaven said, the kingdoms of this world have become the kingdoms of our Lord and of His Christ, and He shall reign forever and ever. And He has now avenged the blood of these dead ones. In verse 18, it says, the nations were angry, and thy wrath has come. Nations were angry, and thy wrath has come, and the time of the dead, that they should be judged, and that thou shouldest give reward unto thy servants, the prophets. The only prophets referred to in the Bible as God's servants, the prophets, are the Old Testament prophets. No New Testament prophet is ever referred to as one of God's servants, the prophets, and of the saints, and of them that fear thy name, small in grace, and shouldest destroy them which destroy the earth. So when it's all over, the city has been destroyed as vengeance from God in order to avenge the blood of the prophets. You have the same thing in the second section. That whenever this city is destroyed, it's destroyed as vengeance from God, and there is the statement made, rejoice over her, thou heaven, and ye holy apostles and prophets, for God hath avenged you on her. And then again in verse 24, in her was found the blood of prophets and of saints and of all that were slain upon the earth. This city that is destroyed had the blood of prophets upon her. And Jesus said, remember, it cannot be that a prophet perish out of Jerusalem. Now, I want to show you how that only Jerusalem fits the characteristics of Babylon the Great. Rome does not fit it at all. Okay. No, that's all right for the time being. Just give us the topic. I want us to notice the characteristics of Babylon the Great. There's about 13 or 14 of them, and we'll put them up there, and then we'll come back, and then we'll show the comparison. These are the things that are said about Babylon the Great, portrayed for us in chapter 17 of Revelation, and in some of the other texts there are some mentions made of. First of all, she sat upon many waters, which are identified in verse 15 of the chapter as peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. She is identified as in association with the fact that the kings of the earth committed fornication with her, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication. Chapter 14 and 8, 17 and 2 and 18 and 3. And Babylon sat upon the beast and was carried by the beast. The beast is developed in chapter 13 and makes a reappearance in chapter 17. And this time, Babylon as the harlot is sitting upon her. Now, you'll notice that she is not the beast. She's not any part of the beast. She's simply carried by the beast. In chapter 17 and verse 4 and 18 and 6, we learn that Babylon was arrayed in purple and scarlet and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, and a golden cup in her hand, full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. In chapter 17 and 5, on her forehead is inscribed mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. In chapter 17 and 18 it is said, Babylon is that great city which reigneth over the kings of the earth. In chapter 16 and 19 it is said of Babylon that she is divided into three different parts. And then as a persecutor, in Babylon was found the blood of saints, martyrs of Jesus, prophets, and all that were slain upon the earth, 17 and 6 and 18 and 24. Now, if you'll give me the next page, we'll get those, and then we'll come back to this one. There are just a few more here that I want you to observe. In chapter 18 and 2, Babylon became the habitation of devils, the hold of every foul spirit, and the cage of every unclean and hateful bird. In chapter 18 and 4, we learn of her that God's people are to come out of her, lest they be partakers of her sins and her plagues. In chapter 18 and 7, Babylon said in her heart, I set a queen and am no widow, and shall see no sorrow. In chapter 17 and 16, the ten horns of the beast were to hate the whore, make her desolate, naked, eat her flesh, and burn her with fire. Death, mourning, famine, and utter burning were to be the result. Babylon was totally destroyed. Babylon was to be rewarded double for her works, 18 and 6. And last of all, the heavens, saints, apostles, and prophets were avenged on Babylon with her destruction. Now, let's take a look at the comparison of these characteristics with both Rome and Jerusalem and see what it looks like from a standpoint of how they match up. First of all, up there, Babylon sat upon many waters, which are peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. Well, that could be said of Rome, couldn't it? Because she was ruled over she ruled over all kindreds and tongues and nations in chapter 13 and verse 7. That's said of her there. But it's also true of Jerusalem. Spiritually, Jerusalem ruled over the Jews scattered into all the nations of the world. Acts chapter 2, verses 5 through 11 mentions some 15 nationalities present on Pentecost and says that Jews out of every nation under heaven. And Josephus relates the fact that the Jews were scattered into every nation under heaven. Jews were a part of those nations. And Jerusalem was supported and carried and kept going as the capital of the Israelite nation because of the fact that she was the spiritual capital of the Jews throughout the world. So Jerusalem spiritually fits it from that standpoint as well. Alright, the kings of the earth committed fornication with Babylon, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication. Rome would certainly qualify as guilty of this as political, economic, and religious fornication, as was Babylon and even Assyria and other Old Testament dignitaries that are Old Testament cities that are referred to. But when it comes to Jerusalem, we have no doubt. She is accused betimes in the Old Testament scriptures of fornication. In fact, Ezekiel says of her that she was old in adulteries before Rome was ever born. As a nation, the city of Jerusalem and the nation of Israel were old in adultery and fornication. So, rightfully, Jerusalem can be so accused. Babylon sat upon the beast and was carried by it. But the woman now is not the beast. The beast was developed in chapter 13. There was no woman on it. When the beast is destroyed in chapter 19, there's no woman on it. So the beast is not, or the woman is not the beast and really no part of the beast. And Rome doesn't fit the picture here because Rome was the beast. Rome was the beast. Jerusalem was not the beast or any part of the beast. Judaism was a law from the empire, refused to accept a position with the empire and was tolerated and protected by the empire. Now here's the whole point. The Jews, though Judea was a part of a province, of a Roman province, were under the dominion and power, but only as a conquered people, not willingly. They did not surrender themselves as many peoples of the Roman Empire had done, or even willingly come under their domain. Some of them even asked to be under their domain, but not the Jews. They did not like it, and there were people who were among the Jews who were constantly fighting the fact that they were a subjected people to Rome. So Jerusalem and Judaism was lost from the empire, but at the same time, they were tolerated by the Roman Empire. What the Roman Empire would usually do in a case like that is just to bring them into submission and cause them to submit and do what they wanted to do regardless. You see, because the Roman Empire demanded the submission of its people first to them. And secondly, if they wanted to be religious, okay. But in the case of the Jews, it was just the opposite. The Jews had to worship God first, and Rome had to come second. Rome didn't like it, but Rome accepted it. And during the time when Julius Caesar was turning the empire, or rather the republic, into an empire, he issued decrees as well as the Senate permitting the Jews to have their religion and their first allegiance to God at Jerusalem, and to let it be to Rome second. And so in that sense, you see, they were carried by the empire. And that's the idea. They were permitted and tolerated and protected by the empire. In the fourth place, Babylon was arrayed in purple and scarlet, and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, and a golden cup in her hand, full of abomination and filthiness of her fornication. It is possible, I suppose, to characterize Rome that way, but there's no question about Jerusalem, because she's described that way even in the Old Testament scriptures. In Jeremiah 4:30, Ezekiel 16, the whole chapter, pictures her in that particular light. On her forehead is inscribed mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. Rome could never be described as the mother of harlots. As I said before, Rome wasn't even established until 753 B.C. At that time, the nation of Israel were already old in adulteries, before she was ever born. You might call her the daughter of harlots. You might refer to Rome as the queen of harlots at John's time, but never as the mother of harlots. But Jerusalem you can refer to as the mother of harlots, because she goes back so long. And then Babylon is pictured as that great city which reigneth over the kings of the earth. Certainly Rome, through the sovereignty of her kings, ruled over the kings of the earth. No question about that. But I think here is something that is missed when this verse is looked at. She is that great city which ruleth over the kings of the earth. Rome as a city never ruled anybody. But Jerusalem as a city ruled, because she was the holy city. She was the only city in the world ever to that time in that position. There are some other cities today that are like it. Mecca, as the capital of Islam and Mohammedism. But Jerusalem up to that time was the only city in the world ever had that position. And she ruled over the kings of the earth. She had a position that was greater than that. And she even manipulated the Roman kings. I was sitting in a class conducted by Connie Adams, in which he was talking about the period between the Testaments, and he was telling about the times that the Jews were being demanded by the Romans that they give their first tribute to Rome rather than to God. And they sat in on a demonstration. They began to, they began to demonstrate before the Senate. And I raised my hand back there and I said, "Connie, did they win?" He said, "Yes, they got their way." And that's the point. The point is that they were able to manipulate through their religion to get their ways. And they got them. They always got their ways in that particular way. And that's the way in which they ruled even over the kings of the earth. They ruled even over the Roman kings in that sense. In 16 and 9, Babylon is divided into three parts. There is no satisfactory explanation that I know of in relationship to Rome being divided into three parts, but Jerusalem was divided into three parts in two ways, both geographically and politically. Geographically, it was divided into the upper city, the lower city, and Ophel. And politically, during the final stages of the war against Jerusalem, it was divided politically into three parts that were warring against each other. There was civil war going on in Jerusalem at the time that the Romans were fighting against them. And the only time they were united is when they were fighting against the Romans. So it was divided into three parts. Babylon as a persecutor,
The blood found in Babel was that of saints, martyrs of Jesus, prophets, and all that were slain upon the earth. The blood found in Rome was only the martyrs of Jesus. Jesus said no prophet could perish there. Remember it? For it cannot be that a prophet perish out of Jerusalem. In Jerusalem, though, as a persecutor, in her was found the blood of apostles and prophets and all the righteous blood shed upon the earth. So she fits the bill. And looking at these others, we see the same thing develop. Babylon became the habitation of devils, the hold of every foul spirit, and the cage of every unclean and hateful bird. While this may, in some sense, be true of Rome, I certainly don't know how to explain it myself, and I really don't remember ever reading anybody that did give a good explanation of that. But Josephus doesn't leave any doubt about it. The people against whom the war was fought with the Romans is described by Josephus as being the scum, the abortive offspring of our nation. And the reason was that this scum had killed all the good that there was. There wasn't anything left but them. And so it became an habitation for devils, the hold of every foul spirit, a cage for every unclean and hateful bird because of its walled position and the fact that they were caught there by the war. All right, in Babylon's characteristic, God's people are called to come out of her lest they be partakers of her sins and her plagues. There is no recorded call or even reason for a call for God's people to come out of Rome. What reason would there have been for a call for God's people to come out of Rome? Did you know that Rome hasn't suffered to this day for her sins? Rome has never been destroyed. Never been. You may have something news to you. It was news to a fellow I was studying with recently when I suggested that to him, and he looked rather shocked, and I said, just show me when. And he hasn't yet. It hasn't happened. But Jerusalem Jesus foretold her destruction and gave instructions for his disciples to leave lest they suffer because of her sin. Matthew 24, Mark 13, and Luke 21. Babylon said in her heart, I set a queen and am no widow and shall see no sorrow. As Babylon of old could have described this, so Rome possibly could be pictured as crying this. Jerusalem, though, without any question, could cry it because she was married. She was married unto Jehovah in the Old Testament scriptures. Babylon's destruction, the 10 horns of the beast were to hate the whore, make her desolate, naked, eat her flesh, burn her with fire, death, mourning, famine, and utter burning were the results. Babylon was totally destroyed. When, where, how, and by whom was Rome destroyed? Rome was captured and conquered, but not destroyed. Did you know Rome is called the Eternal City? And do you know why? Because she has never been destroyed since the day she was built. Some fellow told me, he said, haven't you seen all those ruins over there? That's weather destruction. There's a very fast difference between weather destruction. That certainly is danger from God. And over an existence, continual existence of 2,700 years, nearly. And then Jerusalem, though, the kings of the provinces joined Vespasian and Titus in the war against the Jews, and Jerusalem was made totally naked, desolate, naked. Her citizens cast to the beast. Death, mourning, famine, and total destruction were the results. Babylon was to be rewarded double according to her works. The city of Rome hasn't been rewarded once. But Jerusalem was destroyed twice, 586 and in 70 A.D. And last of all, it says, the heavens, the saints, apostles, and prophets were avenged on Babylon with her destruction. Since these were to be avenged on Jerusalem, there was none left for Rome. And this was avenged on Jerusalem. So you see the reason why. I am very specific. Now I want to take just a few moments here and give you a quick analysis of the whole book. That is dealing not with the first three chapters, but with the middle chapters that we referred to. Starting with the heavenly apocalypse. In chapters 4 and 5, you have the throne of God. And in chapter 4, you have the Old Testament throne scene. That's the throne of God as it's pictured in the Old Testament scene. In the 5th chapter, Jesus makes his appearance as the Lamb of God in the midst of the throne, and the authority is turned over to him. And they begin to sing a new song, and all of the forces of heaven and earth come and bow down in submission before him. This is taught elsewhere in the New Testament scriptures. So, we have the new heaven. I want you to remember that. The new heaven. presented there. Then we have the opening of the seven seals that were upon the book that is taken in chapter 5 by the Lamb. And so he begins to open these seals. In chapter 6 we have the opening of the first six seals. We have the one seal open, the white horse appears, another a red horse, and then a black horse, and then a pale horse. I believe these, quickly stated, represent the forces that were already in the world for the purpose of carrying out the thing that God had determined. That's historical fact. Number 5 deals with the souls under the altar. These are the Old Testament saints in the picture of the scene, making their appearance, crying for their blood to be avenged. In the sixth seal, when it is open, we have a picture of the great tribulation period that was to precede the destruction of Jerusalem. And then this is all either historical fact or in the process of happening at that particular time. Then we have an interlude. In chapter 7, they have an interlude for the purpose of showing that the purposes of God, which had taken place under the advent of Christ to the throne, were being carried out. So you have the redemption of the Old Testament scriptures with the blood of Christ. You have the 144,000 that are identified by John as the saved of the nation of Israel. They're the first fruits unto God in chapter 14. And the first fruits unto God were those who were sanctified and cleansed with the blood of Jesus Christ. And then we have the innumerable multitude out of every nation, which includes everybody. This is the New Testament order here. The sealed number of 144,000, incidentally, would never change. That's the reason why. It's the Old Testament saints. There'll never be another one added to it. There'll never be another one taken from it. Your innumerable multitude is constantly changing because it's constantly being added to and sometimes being taken away from. So you have that picture presented then. Then when you come to chapter 8, you begin to center in on the seventh seal. In the seventh seal, there is the beginning with the silence in heaven. This is because of the magnitude of the thing that is about to be developed here. And there are seven trumpeting angels that make their appearance, and they have six of them in order that come. I believe these to be the development of the events that transpired in the Roman-Jewish war that resulted in the final destruction of the city of Jerusalem. I believe the first trumpeting angel deals with the war in Galilee. That the second one deals with the war against the Jews from a marine standpoint. That is the sea upon the seas. And the third one deals with the fall of the great leader in Galilee and the effect that this had upon the nation, as it is historically revealed in the book of Josephus. That the fourth seal deals with the fact that as far as the nation is concerned, it has been one-third destroyed. Because at this particular point in time, that's exactly what had happened historically. When you get to the ninth chapter and the fifth trumpeting angel, you have the smoke coming out of the bottomless pit, and it turns to locusts, and it's a plague upon the people. I believe this is that scum that I was talking about a while ago that developed into the Jewish side in the war. This is what the war was fought against as far as the Romans were concerned. The sixth angel sounds his trumpet and the forces are gathered together. This is the Roman side. So in the final end, when the war goes to Jerusalem, the first four takes place before you get to Jerusalem. But the last two that we talked about is the development of the participants in the war that would take place at Jerusalem. Then you got another interlude. We got some catching up to do. It's to be thoroughly understood what we're talking about. And so the second interlude here at this point is designed for the purpose of bringing it up to date, that we know what's going to happen, that the mysteries of God are going to be complete, and that this is all being done to fulfill what God promised before. He doesn't want anybody to understand what city he's talking about. So in chapter 11, he identifies the city that is under consideration. It's the city where our Lord was crucified. And so when you get to chapter 11, verse 15, the rest of the chapter, it's all over. The deed's done, and God has avenged the blood of His saints in the Old Testament Scriptures. When you get to the earthly apocalypse, you're looking at the same thing from a different standpoint. Chapter 12, you have a picture of the underlying conflict between Christ and Satan. That's the thing that it's all about. And it's developed in that chapter. You have the forces that develop. Satan is eventually cast out of heaven. He's got to do his meanness here upon the earth. And he goes to war against the saints. And the warring against the saints, he's warring against the woman. And the woman here, of course, is the Jewish church. And then eventually he fails in all of that. But then that is the development of the general picture. When you get into chapter 13, you're developing the specific part in this conflict. The foes in the conflict are introduced. In chapter 13, you've got Satan's helpers introduced. They are the Roman Empire and the pagan religions that serve the empire. In chapter 14, you've got the other side of the conflict, the Lamb with 144,000 introduced. And there are three messages that goes forth. The three messages are the preaching of the gospel, the fall of Babylon, and the warning against worshiping the empire. Those three things in that order. And I want to stop here and make an observation. If Babylon the Great is Rome, the chronology is wrong. The chronology should be this. The angel goes forth with the everlasting gospel. There's a warning against the worshiping of the empire and the emperors and the empire, and then the fall of Babylon, because that's the order in which it really developed. But if it's Jerusalem, the order is right. The gospel is preached, you have the fall of Babylon, which is Jerusalem, and then you have the war developing over the worship of the empire and its emperors. And then in chapter 14, we have two reaping scenes. We have the reaping of the good harvest, and that's the gathering together to heaven of dead saints who have died in the Lord. And in chapter 14, 17 through 20, we have the reaping of the vine of the earth. Now stop and think. Do you know who the vine of the earth is? There's never been but one vine of the earth, and Jesus came through that vine. He's the product of it, God's choice vine, the nation of Israel. Well, that vine there is destroyed. That vine there is put into the wine press and stomped out, if you please. Then after that, we have this having been developed, we have the seven last plagues, or the bowls of wrath, presented in chapter 15, verses 1 through 8. We have the victorious saints who stand upon the sea of glass, and they rejoice as the same seven angels with the seven bowls of wrath are sent forth from God. In chapter 16, we have those bowls of wrath. Now, they closely resemble the seven trumpeting angels. There may be some difference, particularly in the fifth one, as the fifth bowl is poured out upon the seat of the beast. But I think the emphasis there is to get the elements involved from the standpoint of what caused this conflict. And so when you get to the last one, the seventh bowl, you have the accomplishment of all that was intended to be accomplished by that war. But it hasn't been explained. Babylon has been introduced, the city has been destroyed, but it hasn't been identified. Chapter 17 and 18 is designed to identify. So, Babylon is introduced and identified in chapter 17. The fall of Babylon takes place in chapter 18. When you get to chapter 19, they have a victory celebration over Babylon's fall. And then they are reminded that they are forgetting that the thing that they need to be rejoicing over is the fact that the Lamb's marriage has taken place and that they are invited to the marriage supper. So, it then centers upon that. Chapters 19, 11 through 21. The Lamb is victorious, and there is the war that develops between the empire and the pagan religions of the empire. And the Lamb is victorious. And then Satan's helpers, the empire and the religions of the empire, are taken and cast into the lake of fire, and they're destroyed. In chapter 20, we see that Satan is bound. He's bound for 1,000 years. What's he bound for? That he should deceive the nations no more. He's not going to be permitted to use nations as he had used Rome and as he had used these other false religions. That is destroyed, taken away from him for 1,000 years. In this meantime, we see dead saints reigning with Christ who had been persecuted and beheaded by the war over here that had resulted. And the intention is to show us that those dead saints continue to live and reign with Christ, and that they will reign with him throughout that period. But finally, Satan is loosed, and he's permitted to go forth and deceive the nations again. And then he is finally, ultimately destroyed, after which the final judgment comes. And after having gotten that, we have
a quick explanation without getting to chapters 21 and 22. I appreciate very much your willingness to come and to listen to what I've got to say. I'm interested in you considering these things as being an explanation for the book, and to consider them carefully. I don't fall out with you if you don't agree, but I want you to consider them carefully, and you'll be given opportunity to voice any opinion that you have to voice concerning these things. Let me thank you very much for your attention and your willingness to study these things.